Hey, welcome to Christ United Methodist Church. No matter who you are or where you're at, whether you're up early or out late, we pray this message is right on time. Thanks for tuning in.
In preparation for this morning, I was reminded of a story. A story that's about a pastor and his two boys. The pastor's sister had a tabby cat, and she was going away on vacation, and she asked the pastor, her brother, to watch over the tabby cat while she was gone. He agreed. The tabby cat was outdoor and indoors, and it came inside during the nighttime. The evening was waning on, but the cat had been outside, and the boys had recognized that it had climbed a tree. And this tree was a relatively new tree. It was a sapling, but it was high enough where nobody could climb it because it was too new. And nobody could get to the cat, and the cat would not come down. The boys ran, and they told him, they said, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, the tabby cat's in the tree, and it won't come down." The day was growing weary, and they were tired of waiting, and so the father says, "I don't know what we're going to do." But after thinking for a little bit, he says, "I know exactly what's going to happen. I've got a truck. I've got some rope. I'll tie it into the sapling, and I'll pull that tree and bend it so that that cat will be close to the ground, and we can retrieve the cat and go inside." And that's exactly what happened. So they tied a rope to the truck and tied a rope to the tree, and he started off in that tree bend, and all of a sudden the rope snapped. And rawr! That cat was gone. Out of sight. Never found it. Never found it. A couple Sundays later, this new family comes to church. The pastor meets them, greets them, has a conversation with them afterwards, says, "You know what, I want to welcome you. You're new to the community. We're so thankful that you're here worshiping. Can I come and schedule a visit and talk with you?" He said, "Sure, yeah, we're new to the neighborhood. We live close by." And he said, "Okay, I'll schedule a visit." And his wife made him a pie to bring over, and like a good pastor, knocked on the door, and the couple received him, a nice man and his wife, and they had an only child. And he sat down in the living room, he was having a piece of pie, and his visitation was drawing to a close. And before they were going to pray, there was a cat that walked in the room, a tabby cat, that had really similar markings to this other cat. And he said, that's interesting. You got a cat." I was like, "Oh yeah." I said, "Pastor, it almost didn't occur to me, but you've got to hear this story. I was in my backyard and I was tending to my garden. It was a hot day. I was sweaty. I wasn't in the best mood. My son came out and he said, Mommy, can we have a cat? I really want a cat." And she says, "No, son, I told you, we've had this conversation before. You're not getting a cat. We're not going to have a cat. This house is brand new. We've just moved in. We're not going to have a cat that lives inside or outdoors, for that matter. I don't want one." He's like, "Oh, Mom, please." And she said, and she looked at her son finally, kind of resolute. She said, "If Jesus wants you to have a cat, he'll give you a cat. Pastor, you won't believe what happened next." Is that what Christians are guilty of on a cosmic level? Making assumptions about certain patterns and drawing conclusions on things that just happen. Are we guilty of reading in the patterns and making meaning in a world really created by chance? Or, you know, are we really the sum total of a random process of time plus matter plus chance? Or does life have a greater meaning and a purpose? And if people have a purpose, then it follows I'm more than just a particle. I'm actually part of a plan. Such questions come from curiosity. And such questions lead to discovery. And I don't know why, but the church doesn't seem to be a place anymore where people can be comfortable asking questions. On a general level, I'm not saying in all places, but it just seems to me that people have a general discomfort seeing church as a crucible for thought, where they can feel comfortable in a small group or in some setting saying, "You know what, I struggle with this. I'm not really sure about this. I've got some questions about this." Over time, people have an impression about church as a place that they can't ask questions and they can't make certain discoveries. They're not really comfortable. But you know what? Scan Scripture. Scan all of Holy Writ, and you'll find that the point at which people's life flourished was the point at which they were comfortable asking questions, namely, of Jesus. You know Nicodemus, the part of the Sanhedrin. He was a higher up, part of the religious elite. Met Jesus at night because he didn't want to be caught with Jesus, but nonetheless had questions. He said, Jesus, we know there's something special about you. Now, people have their own ideas, their own inclinations about who you are. I think that you're from God because there's no other way that you can do the things that you do outside of God. And through that discussion, through the questions Nicodemus asked, and was actually comfortable asking at night, he arrived at a different point. He arrived at a different place. And it's because of his questions that we have the Hope Diamond of Scriptures in John 3:16. Because Jesus responded in that discourse, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. Jacob was one who struggled. Jacob the deceiver, Jacob the supplanter, and he wrestled with God. And by virtue of a wrestling process, came to a newfound identity. Was different, saw the world different, saw himself different. The disciples, for goodness sake, were ones who asked questions. Look at Thomas. I won't believe. I'm empirical. I won't believe until I see. You guys have seen. You guys tell me in faith what you believe you saw, but I'm not going to believe. Thomas says, just show us the way. Jesus says, you know the way. No, we don't know the way. Tell us. I am the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus says. Philip says, Lord, just show us the Father, and it'll be enough. Pull away the veil and show us God. It'll be enough for us. He says, Philip, you've been with me long enough that you still don't know that if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. They've asked questions. Why is the church a place we can ask questions? We're feeling like we're comfortable asking questions. This whole series was built around certain questions, not to solve problems or to give answers, but encouraging us to maybe think again. Yet there's been such a divide in thinking. And, you know, in many circles, we're brought up to think that if you're scientific, you can't be a person of faith. And if you're a person of faith, you can't be scientific. And I think that that's a false dichotomy. C.S. Lewis, one of our great theologians, said, men became scientific in the first place because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. The same is true of people of faith today. Brothers and sisters, let me just address this if you've ever been confused. Faith isn't devoid of reason. Rather, reason should be the vehicle that draws us to it, that draws us to faith, that brings us to it. And both of those, faith and reason, irrespective of what camp you kind of reside in, people say, I'm a person of reason and therefore not a person of faith, or person of faith, therefore I'm not a person of reason, but that's not true at all. Can we not raise up both and understand that a camp of faith and a camp of reason both say or both agree that at some point that which came to exist has a cause? I'm not introducing proofs of the God's existence, but I do want to make some pointers that make belief in God a most reasonable and rational thing. We understand as a people of faith that when there was a beginning, and there was, that we know the beginner behind the beginning. In fact, our scriptures, our sacred text says in Genesis, if we can have that passage, in Genesis 1, verses 1 to 5, you're quite familiar with this, was that in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, there was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be. God spoke. God issued a word, and by virtue of the word became something. It became material. God spoke and said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and so God separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. We stop there, and a lot of people kind of get hung up in the book of Genesis because of certain ways of seeing creation. I'm not so much concerned about how God created, whether you're a creationist or some other position. I'm not so concerned. I'm not so sure the book of Genesis is concerned about how God created, but the whole of Genesis itself is to talk about that God created, and to tell a larger narrative that's much more involving us and humanity than anything else. But in the beginning, before there was a beginning, there was a beginner. And I want to offer, as a first point, brothers and sisters, a note that says, "That which came to exist has a cause. That which came to exist has a cause." Certain camps can find agreement that which came to exist have a cause. No matter how you section physical concrete reality, what you end up with, brothers and sisters, is a state of affairs that doesn't have the reason for its existence in itself. It owes its being to something else. It's not self-explanatory. For instance, if we have an apple, the apple doesn't have the reason for its existence in itself. There's something to explain its existence, which is the pre-existence of the tree. The tree had to exist before the apple for the apple to exist. But the problem is, there's something that came before the tree. The tree can't explain its own existence. So, we go back all the way to the beginning series of causes. Since we can't have an infinite number of causes, we agree that there was a beginning point. A lot of secular scientists ascribe to the reality of a Big Bang, that there was a bang that spurred the formation of the universe as we know it. But go all the way back to the beginning series of causes, and we can't have an infinite number of causes to bring us to the present, kind of like a domino. If I push the domino, its effect would carry on all to the rest of the standing dominoes, and if they tracked, they would get back to the beginning mover that moved those dominoes. All causes had to be explained by one self-existent cause that isn't physical, that is outside of nature. And according to the Christian worldview, we name that as part of God. It's a worldview that attributes creation of the universe to God. And some folks counter. They say, okay, well, if everything has a starting point, then where is God's starting point? In other words, who created God? Who came before God? And I want to clarify that our first point has to do with that which came to exist. That which came to exist has a cause. So who created God? The question reframed is almost like asking, when did a being who always existed come to exist? Everything finite, says the argument. Everything finite has a beginning, and beginnings only exist within time because time itself had a beginning. Now, let's understand this. If there was a beginning of time and space and matter, the beginner of that had to be timeless, spaceless, not finite, but infinite. If our beginning had a beginner, that beginner must have qualities or attributes of timelessness, spacelessness, and infinitude. If what we see is natural, if what we see is space and time and matter and something finite, the mover behind that had to be spaceless, timeless, infinite, and not in nature, but above nature, supernatural. And also with incredible precision. Now, this is some of the interactive portion of my message. But I did some research, and there's a mathematical scientist. He's actually a mathematical physicist. His name is John Polkinghorne. I don't expect you to remember his name, but he's compiled years of research and investigated with colleagues who discussed the contingencies that were necessary at the formation of the universe, its expansion and contraction, and finally to a point where that universe was sustained. He talked about the conditions that were necessary for the universe and its expansion and contraction rate to be just right so that it wouldn't implode and collapse on itself in a ball of fire. He says that the contingencies for the formation of the universe to take form in the initial phases as it expanded and contracted had to be so exact and the margin of error so small, it would be like taking aim at a 1 square inch object at the other side of the known universe 20 billion light years away and hitting it bullseye. This physicist says that's accurate in 1 part in 10 to the power of 123. Now, if you were to break down how many zeros that is and take all the particles of our world and place a particle on each zero, we would have enough particles. Just to give you an idea of the immensity of the universe and the fine-tuning that had to exist for the universe to sustain itself in that state, 20 billion light years away and hitting it bullseye. Furthermore, there's some astronomers. Again, I don't expect you to remember their names. Frederick Hoyle and N.C. Wickersham found that the odds of the random formation of a single enzyme, which is the building block of the gene, which is the building block of a cell, the formation of a single enzyme from amino acids anywhere on our planet's surface are 1 in 10 to the power of 20. But we have 2,000 enzymes that we've identified. And the chance of obtaining all of those in one random trial is 1 part in 10 to the power of 440,000. It's immense. That it seems that there was something about our universe that not only caused space and time and material to come into existence, but it had to do so with precise fine-tuning, precision, and intelligence. Arnold Penzias of such fine-tuning says, astrology leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the right conditions required to permit life, and one which has the underlying, one might say, supernatural plan, a plan that wasn't merely put together. What's interesting, brothers and sisters, as I transition in our time, what's interesting is the more we've excelled in understanding how the world operates, the more we felt we didn't need to account for our Creator. And it's interesting, it's funny, isn't it, that instead of our wonder stirring with each discovery, wonder stops with each discovery, and we stop asking questions. It's almost like mechanics. We've become so familiar with the mechanisms of the motor that we hadn't stopped to give credence that there was somebody who had a plan behind that motor in the first place. We discounted the mind of a manufacturer. And so in so many ways, we look at the world and we plumb its depths, we make new discoveries, and we say, ha, now that we know something of pistons and the internal combustion of an engine, how foolish it was for us to think that a Henry Ford could have ever been responsible for such a thing. And Henry Ford saying, hello, I'm here. Here I am. That was me. I was behind that. So, brothers and sisters, as I transition, is it possible that the design we see around us reasonably points to a designer? Some might counter to say, well, Pastor Jake, you're kind of foolish as a person of faith to say you see design, but really it's just the appearance of design. You know, have you ever walked the beach? You ever come to the beach on vacation and there are pieces of driftwood that have kind of come together in a formation or shape that you thought was kind of geometric? You know, if you combed the beach and there are 3 pieces of driftwood that came together in a perfect triangle, you could assume that because of the pattern of the waves over a long period of time, those pieces just came together in a way that had the appearance of design. You could reasonably say that. It could have been. But what if you were to comb the beach and you were to come across lettering written in the sand, in deep lettering, and it said, Go Patriots. Not New England. But Willing Park. What if you saw the words, Go Patriots? Now, you couldn't have assumed that 12 billion years and over the formation of time, wind, and weather could have put that together. Because why? Every time you see language, you see intelligibility. You wouldn't assume that, just like you couldn't believe that the dictionary randomly came together because of an explosion in a printing press. Anytime you see language, you see intelligibility, which is why I reference to the first chapter of John. When you see language, you see intelligibility. And when you see intelligibility, you see a power that's greater than you, even if you don't see it outright. First part of John said, in the beginning, its own creation account, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And nothing came into existence that was not from the Word. He was in the beginning with God. And all things came into being through Him, and without Him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in Him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The Word, a spoken Word, a Word that was given from the beginning, let there be, and it was good. The Word was God. The Word was with God, and in the fullness of time, the Word became flesh. Anytime you see language, you see intelligibility. Get me, don't lose me. Don't lose me here. I can't lose you here. As I close, I need you to understand, well, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness doesn't overcome it. I need you to see this, that behind every message is a mind. Behind every message is a mind. When astronauts landed on the moon for the first time, there was no message written in the dust to greet them there. But when they stepped off of the platform and they looked around at all that they saw, what they saw was enough to prompt them to quote not any philosopher, not any great book that they knew, but what they quoted in that time was the beginning book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let me show you a picture here real quick. This is a mega Centauri. It is the largest cluster of stars in our Milky Way galaxy. The Omega Centauri is 15,800 light years away. Did some research. It's 150 light years wide. By the way, if you want some context, one light year is 6 trillion miles. It's an amazing distance. And if we counted every star in that frame, so says scientists, a rate at one star per second, it would take us years to count. That Omega Centauri is in our Milky Way galaxy. And our Milky Way galaxy is tremendous. That's where we are. This galaxy. And the sun and its immensity. If we tried to fill up the sun with a planet Earth, you know how many Earths it would take to fill up the sun? 1.3 million Earths. 1.3 million copies of our planet in density and size. The distance between Earth and the sun is 93 million miles, and it would take 1.3 million Earths to fill up the sun. Now I want to ask, you know, how big would you feel given the immensity of the universe? How big would little you feel given the immensity of the universe? If the universe was a white sheet of paper and you were to depict your significance in it, even that dot would be too big. If you were to depict your significance compared to the size of the universe, I'm not so sure how we could represent it. I feel so small given the immensity of the universe around us. But astronomer David Block, as I close, he talks about how we're carbon-based life forms, and he teaches on electromagnetic forces and nuclear forces that I don't understand, and how carbon only exists when forces are held in a certain equilibrium. When we compare our significance to the significance of the universe, perhaps this quote from Nobel Prize winner Robert Jastrow, who was a skeptic himself, will put things in perspective. He says, "We shouldn't be surprised that we live in a universe so large, for we couldn't possibly live in a universe any smaller." Carbon-based life forms, us, we couldn't possibly live in a universe any smaller. And so the size of the universe is just right to contain life. Life here. Life here specifically. This is the Rose Window at York Minster Cathedral in England. You familiar with that? That's a picture of the Rose Window. They had recently, in recent years past, they had refurbished the window. But the window is very, very intricately designed, and they had to do some restoration work on the window. Let me give you a closer look. The Rose Window has millions of pieces. And the Rose Window came together not by chance, not by randomness, but by the decisive hand of one designer, one artist that it took a long time to assemble. That's the Rose Window. Look at how beautiful. Look at how decorative. Look at how ornate it is. Look at how orderly that window is. I want to show you another slide. Before I do that, I want to say that in the restoration project, people paid, over a period of 4 years, $4 million to restore that window the way that it is. It was the highest possible price. Thousands of pieces formed and fashioned into one coherent, beautiful piece by the hand of a designer. I want to show you this. This comes by a presentation that was given by Francis Collins, who happened to be the head of the Human Genome Project that did some groundbreaking work in mapping DNA. This is a picture of the horizontal strand of our double helix. That's a strand of DNA. Let me give you some information about that. I couldn't remember it myself, but one cell has 23 pairs of chromosomes. Each chromosome contains a strand of DNA 6 foot long. There are 3.2 billion bits of information organized by a four-letter alphabet in our DNA. in our DNA, and that alphabet formed letter combinations at a different sequence paired together to make you and you uniquely. Francis Collins did a presentation who actually supplied that window, but he also took that DNA strand, and if you were to look at it like you're looking down a barrel of a gun, see the end of that strand, how it kind of gets tight at the end? It's almost like you're looking down the tube. This is what you would see. 3.2 billion bits of information in a four-letter alphabet in our DNA that's arranged in different sequences and pairs to form you and you uniquely. Now take a look at those designs, and perhaps maybe you might be able to think again. It gives a different meaning to a word, made flesh. Theologian and scientist John Lennox says, all of us, as I close, all of us have to choose the presupposition with which we start. And there aren't many options, just two. Either human intelligence owes its origins to matter, or there's a creator. Strange, is it not, he says, that some people claim that it's their intelligence that leads them to prefer matter to a maker. $4.1 million was paid to fix the broken rose window. Restoration comes with a price. And if you follow Jesus long enough, friends, you'll know that that notion is almost an unavoidably certain notion. That indeed, restoration comes with a price. If not, perhaps this will move you to think again. So what's behind you? Matter or a maker? We have to choose. It could be matter. It could be a maker. We're going to have to decide, but we have to let our lives display our decision. In a world that constantly seeks a sign, some empirical evidence, despite some of the most persuasive arguments available, I'm convinced, brothers and sisters, that the most powerful proofs for the existence of God will be displayed not in theories and not in lectures, not in presentations like this, but it'll be proven. It'll be exemplified. It'll be displayed in the hands and feet of those who call themselves disciples. Friends, to love in the midst of disloyalty, to extend grace where there's no justifiable reason to give it, to forgive what others say to forbid it, to give sacrificially to meet another's need and desperation, to do that is miraculous. To do that goes above what's natural. To do that is supernatural. The power to change someone's heart using love is greater than the power to change their minds using arguments. And perhaps the letter of our lives and the letter of our lips, of our spoken word lived and acted out, might cause others for whom Christ is a stranger to perhaps think again. In Jesus' name.
On behalf of all of us here at Christ Church, I want to thank you for hanging out and tuning in. Continue to check us out online, but better yet, we'd love to have you worship with us on Sunday mornings, starting at 8:30 a.m. in the chapel or 11 o'clock in our main sanctuary. Until then, may God bless you so that you can bless others.